All right, here we go, people.
Y'all ready for the big show?
Yeah!
Pirate Nerd Radio.
Nerds! 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 Nerds!
Look, we are professional broadcasters of the future.
What a nerd.
Nerd alert!
Nerd!
There must be so much nerd sex happening tonight.
Uh-oh, nerd alert, man.
We're commandeering a radio station in the name of nerd freedom.
All right, enough chit-chat, everyone.
It's showtime.
This week in Nerd News. Dan Riskin and head nerd, Jim Richards.
Very good. Dan, how are you?
I'm well, but you know, I was listening to you have your conversation just before I came on, and you were talking about action movies.
Yeah.
And you asked the great question, is Alien, is that a horror or is it an action movie? And I think the reason you might be remembering it as ambiguous on that front is because Alien, directed by Ridley Scott, was very much a horror, and Aliens, directed by James Cameron, was very much an action movie. And I watched them back to back on a flight not too long ago, and they're totally different movies. Very fun to watch back to back. The first one, in my opinion, is really like the scary sort of like haunting one that sort of gave that whole story and the xenomorph thing like a real feel, like in our culture. The second one's kind of a shoot 'em up, you know, looks like a Schwarzenegger movie, but they're both fun. They're both good.
Very good. Okay, so you're saying that franchise is diverse, is what you're saying?
Yeah, two different directors with two different takes on like the premise and what they did with it. And it's actually a fun back-to-back. If you're ever looking for something to do with whatever number of hours that is, if you ever got a long flight and you have access to those, download them to your phone before you go. But the first one really is like, it was spectacular. And Sigourney Weaver is like the head person that sort of takes that stuff on. She's amazing. But there's also like, you could tell it's the 80s because like she's needlessly walking around in her underwear for parts of the movie, and you're like, come on, did you have to do that? They wouldn't do as much of that today, I think, as they did back then. So it really smells of its era, but it's very different from the other stuff around it.
David Cooper was in the studio last night, and you actually went out for lunch with him today, or you went out for coffee?
We were going for a coffee, but David Cooper showed up really hungry, so we went into the coffee shop, and he said, I got to find something good to eat. The coffee shop didn't have enough, so we walked over to another place so he could eat a sandwich in front of me, and then we walked back to the coffee shop so we could have tea together. So it was a whole thing. It was like a triple date.
Yeah, and that was exciting?
It was good. It was good. We talked about you the whole time and how much we like you, of course. But, you know, I talk to that guy over the radio all the time, and sometimes I can see him for, like, a Zoom chat when we're talking, but it's always nice to actually, like, have a conversation.
Was he gaseous? He was in here in the studio last night, and he was ripe.
Are we really? He smelled a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Terrible.
Mm. Yeah, he'd showered by the time he got to me, or I...
No. He was very gaseous. Yeah, he had gas. Anyway.
Oh, gosh. No, that wasn't happening.
Yeah.
No. Oh, heavens.
Glad we could talk about it, though. He'll be here a little bit later on. Dan Riskin is with us. This is Nerd News. I came across this on social media, and it kind of blew my mind. It's a podcast talking about the ability of trees. They were talking about trees being able to adapt to figuring out what bug was biting them, and then the tree could adapt to making itself taste like something the bug wouldn't want to bite. So let's play the clip.
Did you know that trees, yeah, if there's an insect that is on that tree, based on the insect's saliva, the tree can tell what kind of insect it is, and then it will release a chemical into the air that would draw the predator of that insect to the tree. It will also release a chemical in the air to alert the other trees in the area, and so when that insect goes to the other trees, they've already been alerted, and they've changed the taste of their leaves so that when the insect bites it, it doesn't like it. This is real science.
So there's two things in there. He's claiming that trees can send out some sort of message to the predator of the bug that's biting it. So the bug that's biting it will be eaten by, I don't know what, bats. But also saying that it can send messages to other trees saying, hey, you might want to change the way you taste, or this bug is going to bite you too. Are those two things true?
Yeah, those are the two things that are right that he said. The thing that I'm not sure about, and I haven't done a deep dive, but I don't think the tree senses the saliva of the insect. I think that it's more like the tree senses what kind of damage it's getting done. So trees can sense, and I say trees, but plants. Plants can sense vibrations from something like chewing on its leaves, for example. Or it can sense, you know, other kinds of predation, maybe an aphid sticking its proboscis in or something like that. that. Like, it can sort of characterize different kinds of attacks. But in general, it usually has, you know, just a suite of different things that it'll do in response. So a plant can start producing basically pesticides and put them in its tissues, and those things cost a lot for the tree. So it doesn't make them all the time, but if it's under attack, it'll start producing more of these things. And so it does that. And so you'll see that as ants come onto a bunch of branches and start eating the leaves, the tree will start changing, start making pesticides, and eventually the concentration of those gets high enough that the ants stop feeding on it and they have to move on to another plant, which is, that's really cool, and it makes sense. I mean, the plant doesn't waste energy on it until it needs to, and then it spends a bunch of energy on defenses, and then once those things go away, it stops doing that again. But what the second piece that they're communicating with other plants, I mean, yes, that's what's happening. So on the one hand, when a plant gets injured, it sends off chemicals, and other plants are sensitive to those chemicals and will respond by making more of these toxins in their tissues. So when you mow the lawn, you know that great smell when you cut the lawn, it smells really nice. That is the smell of injured plants. Those are plants that have all been hacked in half. And that particular smell, I don't believe is an example of this, but that is an example of the way plants do give off odors when they get attacked or when they get injured. And those are odors that members of that same species are going to be sensitive to, and they're going to respond to. And so they have shown that that'll happen. And then the last piece is that sometimes those chemicals are given off in response to the, so let's say a caterpillar is feeding on a tobacco plant. And remember this example. The caterpillar is feeding on the tobacco plant. The tobacco plant's injured. It gives off a smell. That smell attracts a wasp that lays eggs inside the caterpillar.
Wow.
And it's a parasitoid. And so it actually, just like aliens, the way aliens lay eggs inside people, this wasp does that to the caterpillar. And so you can say that the plant is calling the wasp, but I think in evolutionary terms, what's really happening is the plant gives off a smell as a result of being attacked, and the wasp has adapted to it. So now the function of that smell now is to call the wasp over to attack the caterpillar. But that's not really what the plant is thinking, per se.
So now that you've explained it, my follow-up question might sound dumb, but I just want, like, so during a forest fire, do you think trees might be sending some sort of message that, I don't know, does that sound dumb that they're...
No, that's not a dumb question.
Are they saying, are they saying to other trees, hey, get ready, something like, this is crazy. I
wonder if trees do smell smoke and do anything physiologically to prepare themselves for it. You would expect, I mean, that seems like a worthwhile prediction to test. I don't know anything about that, but that's a neat question. That's a really good question.
Thank
I have
you.
Some plant friends that I think I know a couple of people who work on plants out in BC where they have lots of forest fires now thanks to climate change, and I wonder if there's somebody working on that. So I'll check Google Scholar, but then I'm going to send an email to my friend Vivian and see what she says.
Looking forward to hearing from you, Vivian, wherever you are. Let me ask you a question. When I send you a link, are you like, oh, not this guy again, or do you read it and go, oh, that's interesting? Because I know I forgot to ask you about one of the links that I sent you a while ago.
Which one?
Was it the one, like, I think the headline just said, they discovered something really interesting in 20-year-old canned tuna.
Oh, yeah. No, that one rings a bell, but I don't.
Okay, never mind.
I always read the link, and now I'm like, did I read that link? I can't remember. No. There's one about canned wine that we talked about.
Okay, let's talk about canned wine. Canned wine sometimes smells like David Cooper.
Yeah, that's farts. Like, it smells like flatulence. It smells bad. And this is a paper that came out of Cornell University, very fine school, of course. The professors of food science there. And it's this, I guess it's this thing that sometimes if that you can buy wine in a can now, and sometimes you crack it open and it's a couple years old and it smells like somebody passed gas. And they've figured out kind of what it is. And it's actually really interesting because there's sulfur dioxide, which has sulfur in it, doesn't smell bad, but it's used in wines as an antioxidant and an antimicrobial. And it's in all kinds of wines. But sometimes if the lining of the can isn't right, that sulfur dioxide interacts with the aluminum.
Oh.
And then that makes hydrogen sulfide. And that does smell like rotten eggs. And so they've figured out the chemistry of it. And it's just a matter of making a better lining for the cans so that the breakdown of the sulfur dioxide in the wine doesn't happen. So it's kind of a neat, satisfying solution. And of course, whenever something stinks, it's got to be sulfur. Sulfur is always involved.
Who's buying canned wine?
No, I don't know, but somebody, I don't know. Yeah,
it's not a judgment. Never heard of it. I've heard a boxed one, but I've never heard a canned one.
One thing about buying, I have to admit, I haven't looked carefully. I haven't seen canned wine at the LCBO. Maybe they do have it, but they do have small individual sized wines now. And to be honest, like, I don't know, maybe I'm getting older or whatever. I don't drink very much. I drink very little, but I certainly, like, if I have a drink, I probably don't drink again for another week or two. And so a bottle of wine, always two-thirds of it gets wasted. Like, unless my wife and I are both having a whole glass of wine, in which case we drink almost half of the bottle. Like, it's a giant waste. So the smaller serving containers I can get behind for sure.
And I've never had a problem with leftover wine. I've never had a problem with leftover wine. It doesn't exist. But I haven't had a drink in 9 months. But I didn't have a problem back when I was drinking. I just want to let you know that part. All right, we're with Dan Riskin. Nerd News continues here on the iHeartTalk Radio Network.
Welcome back to News Talk Tonight with Jim Richards on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Ask a medium anything. America's top psychic, Matt Frazier, will be here in 15 minutes' time. Ask a medium anything. Did you hear, Dan Riskin, Nerd News with us, did you hear, Dan, of the story of a psychic little person escaping from jail?
No.
A small medium at large.
Nice.
Yeah. So we've got Ask a Medium Anything coming up in about 15 minutes time, 14 minutes time right now here on the iHeartTalk Radio Network. All right, we continue right now with Nerd News. Dan Riskin is with us, and we're talking about some of the big news stories over the past 7 days. By the way, I don't want to go back. Well, the eclipse, you remember that?
The eclipse. I do remember the eclipse, yeah.
I saw a piece of the video that was going around from Niagara Falls that I hadn't seen until like 2 days ago, where people were singing in Niagara Falls when it was at peak eclipse. Ain't no sunshine when you're gone. Ain't no,
really?
Yeah, have you seen that?
No.
I thought it was pretty moving. Anyway.
You know what? Maybe I've said this already, but I think that the most amazing thing about the eclipse experience for every single person I talk to about it is when they talk about the way that they felt during the eclipse and how it, whenever they say there was an emotional aspect to it, which is usually part of the conversation, they talk about the people around them and they talk about the experience they had sharing it with people and the applause around them and people cheering and this feeling of camaraderie. And I really think I did not see that coming. I did not think that would be like one of the dominant themes from the eclipse, but I really do think, and that your video anecdote bears that out, but it's for me, that was definitely true. It was when people cheered all up and down the beach during totality, it gave me goosebumps in a huge way. Might have been the cold too, because it was colder.
Yeah, we didn't see that because of big office towers and office buildings. Nobody thought about that when planning a downtown in this city that people wouldn't be able to see an eclipse. I think urban planning should center around that, but we weren't able to see it. But it did get dark, and I remember it was quite the moment. And then I cracked a joke, and I think I ruined it for a lot of people. And
that's good.
Yeah, good for me.
That's what you do. Hey, by the way, we were talking before the break, and you said, you know, I sent you these weird emails and something about Canada. And I was like, what? So anyway, while we were in commercial there, I was listening to the commercials, of course, because I always do. I enjoy them very much.
Yep.
But I also went and looked for the email, and I found it. And I remember that story. That's where they had these expired cans of salmon, and researchers went through them and looked for all the parasitic worms they could find in the salmon from those. And they used them as time capsules to see what the parasitic diversity is of the salmon. And I don't remember like what their conclusion was. They had four different kinds of salmon, and they were looking at the diversity and how it changed over time, because these cans went back like 20, 30 years or something like that. And they were able to show, you know, different changes in how many parasites they have. And you don't think of the parasites.
No,
that are in
you
cans.
Don't.
They won't hurt you. but like there's material in there. Like, you know, they've chopped up these fish. They've got issues. And so sometimes there's material of parasites in there. And so with the right techniques, you can tease that out to know what the deal is with these fish. I'm scaring everybody off.
No. You're like 3 seconds away from having me have a gagging reflex on the radio. But that's my, it was my topic. I sent it to you.
You picked it. You sent me the message.
I know. But while I heard you talk about parasites in a can of Sam, I was like quickly thinking, like, how do I suppress this gagging? I guess I can turn my microphone off.
Gag away. That's half the fun of these parasites. I will say, like, I've spent a lot of time talking about parasites because I worked on this TV show in the States called Monsters Inside Me. And it, you know, it's the stories of people and the parasites they get. And so we're constantly like visiting different stories and all this stuff. But people do have like a really visceral reflex to parasites, and it makes evolutionary sense. And one of the things I find so interesting is, like, you know, with scary stories, usually the scariest stories are things that make evolutionary sense. Like, you don't want to be killed by a guy in the woods with a hacksaw or whatever it is. But the scary story of parasites and the grossness of them, it should make you repulsed, because if you open a can of salmon and there's a worm in there, you should know not to eat
exactly.
that.
Exactly. You should.
And your body protects you by making you gag when you see that. So thank you, gag reflex.
You know what you should also know? When somebody says they're about 3 seconds away from gagging on it, you probably should not talk for another 2 minutes about it.
I do. I did it on purpose.
Okay, all right. Yeah, you were very good at it. You're less likely to develop dementia if your job requires you to think a lot. Well, I'm screwed.
Yeah, that's not true. You think a ton. This is a study from 7,000 Norwegians.
Not very well, though, but go ahead.
Well, you do think a lot, which is the point here. There's 7,000 Norwegians in this study, and they were each put into occupational categories. So they had to choose from a list, or they were placed in a list, 300 different occupations. And for each of those occupations, the researchers came up with sort of an index of how mentally demanding the job can be, some jobs being more mentally demanding than others. So, you know, putting lids on canned salmon is not mentally demanding. Hosting a radio show where somebody might try to make you gag while you're talking, that is mentally demanding. And what they found is that people that have a more mentally demanding job had a 66%, people who did not have a mentally demanding job, the people putting the lids on the cans of salmon, had a 66% greater risk of developing cognitive impairment after the age of 70. And people that had very tricky jobs where they had to think a lot had a 31% lower chance. So that's very cool. It shows that, you know, using your brain a lot for work, you're exercising the muscle of your brain, although it's not really a muscle, and that helps stave off some of the effects of old age that can sometimes work against your sharpness.
I mean, we've known that to a certain extent, that you should try as hard as you can to kind of keep your brain occupied.
We have, and there are correlations with, like, getting more education tends to result in better, you know, mental awareness in old age. And the thinking is that as people, you know, when they exercise that brain and they get the kinds of jobs you get with a university education, you end up using your brain more, and so you keep using it. And so it's nice, but I thought it was pretty striking. 66% is a pretty striking number in terms of the power of that relationship. I would have thought it was weaker than that. I mean, we're not talking about we're not saying 66% of people are going to get cognitive impairment. We're saying everybody has a very low chance of getting a cognitive impairment, but it's a tiny bit higher, just 66% greater if you're somebody that had a very boring job for your whole career and now you're 70.
Rats might be able to count.
This is a cool one. Researchers came up with a really neat way to... It's not a big deal for an animal to know a big pile from a small pile. Like, if you put a bunch of food in one pile and a little bit of food in another pile, most animals can sort that out. But in terms of, like, counting the numbers, researchers came up with a way of testing rats that didn't change the quantity overall, but changed the number of things. And they wanted to see if the rats could distinguish them, if they could train them, and they did. And then they blocked a part of the brain that they thought was responsible for this ability, and the rats were still able to tell a big pile from a small pile, but they lost the ability to count. And so they think they've found the part of the brain in rats where counting happens. And this is cool because, you know, even if you go back 20, 30 years, of course humans are the only animals that could do math. Of course humans are the only ones that think about numbers. And now that's just not true at all. And now we have a beginning of a sort of experimental protocol to learn more about how animals perceive numbers, thanks to rats.
All right, Dan, I will text Vashi something tomorrow, so hopefully she'll give me a shout-out when you're on doing Talk Science to Me with Vashi. And people, if you're listening tomorrow, it's all different content. It's entirely different science stuff tomorrow with Vashi on her show. Dan, thank you very much for your time. Have a great night.
You too. Have fun with the medium.
We will ask a psychic, a medium, anything. If you've got a question, 7-10-10. I'm Jim Richards. This, it's the iHeart Talk Radio Network.